Want a chance to win 250 pounds in vouchers? All you have to do is fill out the Ballpark's listener survey. It takes just 15 minutes. The Ballpark podcast is celebrating our 10th anniversary in 2026. And after more than 130 episodes covering U.S. politics, we want to hear from you to shape our next decade. So hit the link in the show notes for the survey details and prize draw terms and conditions. Share your thoughts, and you could be 250 pounds better off.
Hello, and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan U.S. Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, managing editor of the Phelan U.S. Center's blog on U.S. politics and policy, USAP. For much of the post-Cold War era, Europe and Asia were treated as separate strategic worlds. But today, how politics, conflict, and power play across this vast landmass are increasingly intertwined. From China's growing influence in Europe, to deepening Russia-China cooperation, and the ripple effects of Trump's America First policies, Eurasia has emerged as a single, highly contested geopolitical space. These shifts are forcing countries, including India, to rethink old assumptions about alliances, security, and the global balance of power. To discuss these issues, in November 2025, I spoke to Dr. Raja Mohan, Distinguished Fellow at the Council on Strategic and Defense Research in Delhi and a visiting professor at the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. In our conversation, we discussed how Eurasia has become strategically integrated, what Trump's return means for U.S. allies and partners, and how India is navigating a more volatile environment as a rising middle power. We also talked about the future of regional orders in Asia and the pressures reshaping maritime and continental geopolitics. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I think you will too. I began by asking Dr. Raja Mohan to outline his research and current work.
My name is Raja Mohan. I'm associated with several think tanks, with the Council on Strategic and Defense Research, as well as the Institute of American Studies at Jindal Global University. So I was originally a physicist, and I was doing nuclear physics. Then I turned to international relations, looking at nuclear technology and international politics. And when I started out, India had just done the nuclear tests in 1974. So that got me into looking at India's nuclear policy, and with it, eventually more and more of India's strategy and then India's foreign policy. I was also looking at nuclear proliferation issues, and therefore that took me to the whole set of issues on how does nuclear technology get regulated at the global level. And since then, I've expanded that work to look at technology regimes, say, for example, in Antarctica or on space. And now I also look at what it is doing to digital governance, cybersecurity, and most recently, of course, on artificial intelligence and its global governance. So I would say Indian foreign policy, Indian security, Asian geopolitics, and the governance of new technologies. So these are some of the areas I work in.
Thank you so much. So my first question is, could you give us an overview of the importance of Eurasia in both global affairs and with regards to American global strategy and foreign relations right now?
I think Eurasia is a term that has caught on. It is not common if you go back during the Cold War. I think there were two separate theaters, Europe and Asia. But if you look at the pre-Second World War, the integration of Europe and Asia was natural. In a sense, the Europeans conquered Asia, given the colonies in Asia. So the interaction was natural and real. But of course, that was a colonial hegemonic relationship. And then when the Europeans ceded to the Americans as the main power in the East, the U.S. approached this war. Vast region, what you might call a single continent, Eurasia. They approach from the Atlantic side to Europe. So the European security and all range of institutions and strategies that the U.S. developed. On the other hand, from the Pacific coast, they could also reach Asia. And the engagement with Asia, especially Northeast Asia, was dealt with separately. So these two realms were seen as separate. But there was something called the Soviet Union in between, which kind of straddled across both Europe and Asia. But it was really Soviet Union's expanded influence, and Soviet Union itself was an important player in Europe and a bit in Asia. But I think it's the collapse of the Soviet Union. Then the question comes, what do you call those regions? Simply calling them post-Soviet was one option. But increasingly, if you look at most old Russian or Soviet studies departments, a lot of them now talk about Eurasia. More recently, I would say there is also the whole as China and Russia have come together and China's influence and Europe is growing. So now we're beginning to think of these two theaters more integrated because of China-Russia connection. We've also seen North Korean troops in the Ukraine war. So I think this idea that these two theaters are single landmass, they are a single landmass. But I think they've had narratives of political, cultural, intellectual that they saw them as separate. But today, I think in the strategic domain, at least, we're beginning to see it as an integrated theater.
Thank you. But just thinking about people in Europe, do they think of themselves as being part of Eurasia? And do people in India, for example, do they think of themselves as being part of Eurasia?
No, not really. I mean, I think that's part of the problem. I mean, I think for many Europeans, the reference to Eurasia takes them to, it's a Russian term for them, because Russian nationalists have talked about Eurasia, of reconstituting the Soviet spaces. So for many Europeans, it kind of is a negative reaction. And for Indians, I think India has always had a long engagement with Central Asia, Inner Asia sometimes we used to call it. But today, I think the term is beginning to gain acceptance. I would not say it's very widely popular, but my sense is the larger dynamic of the Sino-Russian alliance, and increasingly in the last few years, we've seen more and more Europeans talk about the Indo-Pacific, and we've seen South Korea supply arms to Poland, which went to Ukraine. North Korea sent troops to Russia. So you're seeing the integration that is taking place. And I think that's where I would say the term is gaining acceptance. Certainly the Americans use it now quite a bit to look at the whole geopolitics. And after all, this term, I mean, now I would say it's gaining popularity.
So now that we've set the scene, how has the turn of Trump to the White House and the rise of America First from the White House impacted the US's relations in Eurasia and especially with India?
I think let's first look at what impact of Trump's policies on Europe and Asia. I think one of the central tenets of Trump's policies, I mean, we saw that in the first term, the questioning of alliances, the idea that alliances are a burden on the United States, the allies are free riders, they take advantage of the Americans, while at the same time, to use Trump's word, ripping off America economically. This time, I think Trump has taken that argument far more seriously, pushed it far more vigorously, both the European allies as well as Asian allies. So in operational terms, it has translated into, guys, you have to take care of your own security. I'll still be around, but you'll have to do the heavy lifting. You'll have to take more of the burden in terms of the financial resources. If you recall, this summer, NATO finally said, look, okay, we'll do a 5% of national GDP. I'm not sure they can actually meet it, but the fact is Trump's pressure is working in terms of raising your defense expenditure. Similarly, in Asia, Trump has put enormous pressure with Japan and South Korea that they got to do more on the defense. And another feature of Trump's policies today is actually demanding that the allies invest in the reindustrialization of the United States. The argument being, look, you guys took advantage. We were nice to you for the last 8 years. Now payback time. So for example, Japan had to promise to invest $550 billion. Korea had to promise investment of $350 billion. And the Europeans too have made substantive commitments for investments, for purchases, for rebooting American economy. So in a sense, India is not an ally. So in a sense, it's not been directly part of. But I think India has been affected, of course, by Trump's trade first policies, Trump's attempted reordering the global trading order. India is, in fact, one of the, today, shall we say, is one of the most tariffed country that we have 50% tariff on India. That's still there. On the security side, it's not clear how much Trump is committed to the policies his own first term administration had outlined. For example, Trump had talked about in the first term, national security strategy said, look, Russia and China were both threats. Therefore, US needed alliances and partnerships. India was a partner, not an ally. So much effort went in under the Trump one and the Biden administration to build up partnerships and alliances. But now Trump seems to think he can do direct deals with both Russia and China. As I've seen happen in the last few weeks, Europeans are furious that Trump is cutting a deal on Ukraine directly with Russia. Similarly, in Asia, I think a lot of countries worry Trump might be quite open to doing a bilateral deal with the Chinese, focused on economics, and that the many of the security commitment that US has made to the Asian partners will now be under doubt. Now, I don't think US has withdrawn yet, but I think the very way in which the mixed message has come from Washington. Now, I think most Asians, including India, worry about US-China relationship, much as the Europeans worry about US-Russia relationship.
So when analyzing Eurasia, commentators often frame it as the middle area between the US and China. How helpful is this framing? And is there a better way to conceptualize the importance of this region in terms of competition between great powers?
I wouldn't say it's between US and China. It's actually, China is very much part of the heart of Eurasia. And I'd say it has borders with several countries, including with Russia. I think it's really the, if you go back to the Greek period or even before, people saw that Asia was different from Europe. Though it was very close, if you look in retrospect, you just had to cross the Arabian Peninsula and Iran, then Mediterranean is not too far from the Arabian Sea. But that Asia was the other, a different place. And I think that construction, though physically they were proximate, the notion that these are different areas was there. And then the colonial period, while initially the Europeans who came to Asia tried to integrate, but later saw it as inferiority of the Asian people, they got colonized. So therefore, there was a sense Asia was, shall we say, needed to be mastered and civilized and the great civilization mission, etc. So there again, the regions were seen as different. But I think in the colonial period, there was an Austrian geologist who said, look, actually, these two, they're same geologically. It's a single mass. And I think what seemed a strange idea then, I mean, it was got proved when we had the tectonic plates theory. So there's something called the Eurasian plate. So the geologists were first saying that, look, this doesn't make any sense. But the politics of it were not easy to change. Because when Austrian geologists was talking about this, actually, the peak of colonial period. So there was no way they could see these people as equal. And therefore, you had actually a narrative of Europe and Asia being different. But today, I think you have actually, we talk about Asia rising. We saw China has become a second largest economy and its impact and influence on Europe is growing. So I think the time has come to think of this as actually an increasingly interconnected space. Physically, it has always been, but now geopolitically, it's going to be interconnected.
In your 2021 co-authored book, The New Asian Geopolitics, Military Power and Regional Order, you argue that the three existing versions for regional order in Southeast Asia are unlikely to last in the long term. Could you elaborate on these visions and talk about what makes them unsustainable in light of recent developments?
So I would say the broad three orders that I had talked about, I mean, we had, of course, other co-authors as well. Idea one was the idea of ASEAN-centered regional architecture. See, Asia doesn't have the kind of a single set of unique institutions of the kind that Europe has had, whether it is the European Union, NATO, or more broadly, the European OSCE. Europe had these large institutions. But in Asia, really, the ASEAN-centered architecture was the closest we came to an institutional stuff. So starting from the end of the Cold War, you had the ASEAN try to draw other major powers into this architecture. They created the ASEAN Regional Forum. They created the East Asia Summit, in which the US, Russia, India, a whole lot of countries are partners to it. The second model was really, as China began to rise, the idea of a China-centered regional system. That was the second framing. The ASEAN structure was the closest we thought of collective security. You had actually a China-centered system where the largest power shapes the regional system. And then we had the American and Japanese framing of Indo-Pacific, where actually a more balanced architecture, not a China-centered one. So now I think all the three models are today seem increasingly difficult to sustain. One, the ASEAN is fragmenting. It's unable to stand up to the Chinese pressures. Its ability to get things done has shrunk. For example, through the Myanmar crisis, ASEAN had very little role. ASEAN now has a problem even standing up to fellow countries like Philippines and Vietnam, which are under pressure from China on territorial issues. So you have ASEAN under a bit of a crisis. Then you have China-centered architecture. Well, China's power, since we've written the book, has actually grown, even just say last 5 years. In a way, Chinese dominate the region much more. But then there's also going to be backlash against that a China-centered architecture is unlikely to work because Asia is full of nationalisms. It's not just China, which is nationalist. You have Japanese, Indians, Vietnamese. They've just come out of colonialism barely 100 years ago. And they're not going to simply walk into, let's have happily live ever after under the Chinese hegemony. So that Chinese will have a problem on that. And meanwhile, the American-centered Indo-Pacific is also having problems. While people will look for a balanced architecture, it's increasingly unclear under Trump whether the U.S. is really committed to what the Indo-Pacific strategy was articulated by Trump. Now, it's not clear whether they're committed to it. So will the U.S. says, look, it's too much of a burden. So if the U.S. wants to retreat or retrench, then I think that model is also not going to work. So I think we're going to have a more divided, more contested region in Asia and the Indo-Pacific.
So a significant portion of your work has focused on the emerging role of India as a strong middle power in Eurasia. What consequences does this rise of the world's most populous nation have for American foreign policy in the region?
I think India is rising. It's rising slowly, not like China, which is really already close to $20 trillion, spending almost $300 billion in defense. But India's rise has been slower. It's really today the fourth or fifth largest economy at about $4 trillion. It's also the fourth or fifth largest defense spender. I'm saying fourth or fifth because essentially as the exchange rates change, the positions keep changing. So in a way, compared to where India was 30 years ago, I think India today is an important player. In a way, I think given India's challenges that it has faced from China. The last two decades, I would say India has been drawing closer to the US, closer to the West. But now, given Trump's uncertainty that Trump has introduced, and the fact that India actually has been a target of Trump's tariffs, he's got the maximum tariffs, as we mentioned. So I think there is some rethinking. Look, should India move closer to the US and the West, or should it join hands with Russia and China? You saw that famous handshake of Modi, Xi Jinping, and Vladimir Putin. So I think that's where increasingly the debate has once again acquired a life. But objectively speaking, I think if you look at India's trade, much of it is with the West today, with the US, with Europe, with UK. And it's a people contact that's also, again, mostly with the West. But I think this is where the question then, how does India preserve its autonomy? What does it do to secure its position? This, I think, we'll see next year, whether the institutions that were created, the partnerships and the foundations for it laid during Trump's first term, will they survive the second term? But I sense that, look, whatever the current chaos is, I think that structural convergence between India and the US for a more balanced Asian region, I don't think that will disappear anytime soon. So I would continue to see, notwithstanding the current tempest in the relationship, eventually, I would say India and the US working closer with each other and to seek a more balanced Indian Ocean and the Indo-Pacific region.
So alongside the Eurasian landmass, you've highlighted the need for greater attention on cooperation and maritime security. Could you talk about why this is so important and how America's role in upholding the freedom of the seas has shifted?
I think India, under the British Raj, it was very much part of the great imperial network that Britain had created, and it was very much part of the globalization framework of the 19th century and the early 20th century. And I think post-independence, India became more inward-oriented economy, cut itself off from the rest of the world, especially the West. So the trade became less and less important for India. But today, I think India has become, once again, post-91 reforms. It's again a major trading nation. India's GDP around $4 trillion. Almost 1.5 of it is really exports and imports. So India is one of the most internationally connected regions in terms of its economic profile. So I think once you're a trading nation, your interest in the seas grows up. We've seen the rise of China, for example, has been accompanied by expansion of Chinese Navy, its maritime profile, much like the European powers. Rise of capitalism in Britain and later in Europe also, they're becoming major maritime powers. And the US, as US became a major trading power, major economic power, a sea power became quite central to it. So in that sense, there is much greater interest today in India on maritime issues and maritime opportunities. But if you see India's security for many years was tied down by its territorial conflict with China, its disputes with Pakistan, while it had a free, open maritime borders in the whole peninsula, but it neglected those maritime issues during the Cold War. But today, I think it's rediscovering. And once you're a maritime nation, India is also looking at more partnerships with Japan, with Australia, with the US. That's what we call the quadrilateral framework. And I would say increasingly with the UK, with Europe. So I think the maritime connection gives it a much wider set of options than merely territorial continental dimension that it had.
So looking ahead now, what challenges do you foresee becoming the most pressing for Eurasian countries as they attempt to handle the rise of America First in Washington's foreign policy?
I think the biggest challenge is to figure out where the US is headed. And I think it's really quite amazing if anybody had thought that in 9 months, you have one president, one ruler, can change so much. I think we really, even as we speak, the debate on Ukraine. And is the US going to continue to support Ukraine's territorial integrity? Some of the new proposals raise questions about it. And is Europe really committed to European security? So I think the debate has gone beyond burden sharing. Because I think it was not just about a common objective and burden sharing, but it's actually saying US wants a different relationship with Russia. Similarly, in Asia, it wants a different relationship with China. So are we talking about a great power relationship that the rest of us have to simply adapt to that? Whether it is Europeans or Asians are staring at today, beyond the traditional American framework, US is going to deal directly with Russia and China. And what does it mean for most of our security? And I think that's a very, very big issue. And second, I think it's not just on the security side, but we also have the trade side. That Trump and the US, which was a champion of open trading order, given the political backlash within the US, it's actually basically brought the whole system that itself had built, the GATT and the WTO, were really American creations. Now, in 9 months, we saw the attempt at completely undermining it. So therefore, trade issues. You have security and trade. So the two core pillars of the American order that were created are now under stress. I think this poses questions for everyone in terms of how they're going to adapt to it. So you can't take anything from the US granted. Meanwhile, China is rising. When people talk about China replacing the US, it doesn't. But China doesn't import things from others. It merely exports. It wants a much more hierarchical system. So I think we are in for some real fundamental questions about the world order, about regional balances and regional security.
A question for you. Have you filled out the ballpark survey yet? It's just 15 minutes, helps us get ready for our 10th anniversary, and if you're lucky, you might win £250 in vouchers.
Thank you. I'm going to come back to the world order discussion in a minute. But before we talk about that, alongside India, which US regional allies do you think will be particularly important to watch in the coming years as they attempt to handle Trump's unpredictable foreign policy?
Europe, clearly, it's a pretty large economy. In a sense, many people said, look, Europe was not a geopolitical actor, but is actually an economic actor. But even there, I think they were under enormous pressure to simply cave in to Trump's demands. Now, Europe talks about strategic autonomy. Europe talks about rearming itself. It's not clear how long all this process will take place. But I think Europe has the potential to become a major power and take a larger role, not just on the economic side, but on the security and others. But then Europe is also deeply divided internally. Getting it to do things is hard. Already you're seeing the divisions on Ukraine between Brussels and, say, Budapest. So the Europe, can it rise over its historic internal weaknesses and take up larger responsibilities? So that's one power. I think we're seeing the debate unfold as we speak. Then we talk about Russia because Russia is still enormously weak. In a sense, Russia's economy is only about $2 trillion compared to about 18 for the European Union. Even India is double the size of Russia today. And China in 20 is almost 10 times bigger than Russia's. But Russia has the military power to disrupt the existing order. And I think that's what we've seen happen in Ukraine. What you have is actually Europe, much richer than Russia, is unable to deal with the Russian challenge because Europe was not prepared militarily. And it hoped that the Americans would take care of their military situation. But today, it's not so sure. So therefore, I think many of the assumptions that Europe made about the general security are now under stress. Now, China is the other great power. I mean, I think you have actually China's rising, while China's economic policies, so many of them have seen them as predatory, but it's going to be the second largest economy, and I think it hopes to be the number one. So what it does, there's no certitude. While China is strong externally, it's not clear what's happening in its domestic politics. It's quite opaque. So we've seen historically, anyone familiar with China knows, look, China has always had internal arguments, whether any arguments, whether it's simply one emperor ruling China, it's not by no means clear. So there'll be a lot of uncertainties about China as well. But I think what we've seen happen in the last two decades is also the rise of several middle powers, if you will. Brazil is an actor. Nigeria is a big country. South Africa, India, you have Indonesia. You have a large number of actors who have some agency of their own. So while US and China are at the top and Europe economically is in the top three, you have actually a whole lot of actors. So the problem, of course, here is can they actually work together to shape the order? I'm skeptical of that. I mean, I think we've seen in the BRICS, really, they're not even been able to come together to challenge. In fact, they're partners to Russia and China who are actually disrupting the system. So while the resentment against the US is real, the challenges posed by China and Russia are also fairly substantive. So I think it's a period, I think, of transition. It's a period of confusion, a period of uncertainty. So what comes out at the end of it would depend on what are the kind of choices that US makes, China makes, and many of these middle power make in the coming years.
So this past July, you wrote that the West refuses to disappear and the rest is having a difficult time taking charge. As the US approaches its 250th anniversary next year, is the US-led global order here to stay? And what's stopping the rest from stepping up?
I think there's this constant talk about the West is in decline. I think a lot of times this is actually done by the Western academics themselves. And a lot of people who want to see the West decline, who say, look, now this time it's over. But I think the West has endured. You say, look, if you go back to in the early 20th century, Spengler wrote these two volumes called The Decline of the West. Since then, I mean, we've had waves and waves of writings on Paul Kennedy's, for example, on the rise and fall of great powers. So we've had this sense of the West is going to decline, but of course nothing is permanent. My sense is sometimes this decline is overstated, certainly of the US. We see Europe has declined in a relative sense vis-a-vis America, but the US itself, I mean, is at $30 trillion today, is growing at 3% and is technologically booming. So I don't see the US disappearing. And one way of thinking about Trump, what is he doing with the West? Can the Europeans really revolt against the Americans? Can Japan simply walk away from the US? One way of interpreting what's happening today is the US resetting the terms of the relationship, not abandoning the West as a concept, but of actually regrouping it under terms that are more suitable to itself and suitable to the demands domestically. But the US itself is actually rising, and it's not clear actually whether China will overtake the US at any point in the near future. China is still at $20 trillion on the level of per capita income, etc. The US is really way ahead. And then we have the demographic decline in China, rapid decline of population. We also have the same problem problem in Europe. So in a way, the US retains the top dog position for quite some time to come. So that's one part of the story. The other part, this talk about the rest coming together to beat the West, is again, I think most of the time it's an aspiration or a fear. Some in the West fear that, look, as Europe's foreign policy chief, previous administration in Brussels said, oh my God, the barbarians are coming to destroy the beautiful garden that Europe has. Or the many Asians who feel, look, the time has come, Asia is rising, the non-West is rising. But I think non-West has problems of its own internally. India, China can't get along, for example. The Middle East is not united against Israel. So I would say the fractures are much deeper, if you see, within the non-West rather than the West. So I would say the West as a force will endure. But I think the problem today is, of course, much of the attacks on the West are coming from the West itself. In a sense, today, the argument within the West on liberalism, what were taken to be accepted values within the West, today, Trump and the MAGA is challenging many of those values, not just in terms of the liberal international order, but of liberal values, whether should you go back to Christian values, a set of assumptions about how society should be organized, what we assume to be Western values are actually being challenged within the West itself. So I would say that is a much more serious challenge rather than what China poses or what Russia poses. And we see the US actually, MAGA, intervening in the European domestic politics, in British domestic politics. So I think this is interesting to see how this plays out. In the end, the challenge to the conception of the West is within the West itself.
I think that's a great place for us to finish. But before we do finish, I'd like to give you the opportunity to direct our listeners' attention to any recent or upcoming books, articles, or other projects you're working on that you think they might find to be of interest.
And I've just published a book called India and the Asian Rebalance that just came out a few weeks ago from the International Institute of Strategic Studies in London. It's part of the Adelphi series. It's available on Amazon. I'm also working on a book about India's relationship with Europe. It's one of the big changes in India's engagement with the world has been with Europe. So a lot has happened in the last 5 years. So I'm trying to capture some of that, of India's relationship with the Europeans. And where India talks about multipolarity, normally we think about China and Russia, but actually doing more with the European Union and France and Germany seems to be far more interesting. So finally, I would say I'm also looking at the artificial intelligence and the governance part of globally, whether there can be a model between the total statist model of China or the total corporatist model of the US. So whether there are alternative ways of dealing with it. So these are three broad projects.
Thank you so much. Well, our listeners can find a link to your new book in our show notes, and they should look out for your upcoming resources soon. Raja Mohan, thank you so much for speaking to the Ballpark today.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for having me here.
Dr. Raja Mohan is a distinguished fellow at the Council on Strategic and Defense Research in Delhi and a visiting professor at the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Dr. Raja Mohan for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan US Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On X and Instagram, we're at @LSE_US, and on LinkedIn, we're LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Navin Fatah. A theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and on lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. You can email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @LSE_US. And tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan US Center or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening. Play ball.